More than 50,000 students in Illinois dealt with homelessness last year. Now, one school district is using a new state law to help families find housing using money in its transportation budget. Plus, if you've gotten a call from the IRS, that is definitely a scam. Are you getting more and more robocalls these days? We're going to give you some tips on what to do about them. And Illinois was once home to many stops along the Underground Railroad. The story of just one of those stops at Wheaton College coming up.
The 21st is a production of Illinois Public Media, airing on WILL in Urbana, WUIS in Springfield, WGLT in Normal, WNIJ in DeKalb, and WCBU in Peoria.
That's all this hour on the 21st. Stay tuned. Welcome to the 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. Coming up this hour, the story of how Wheaton College became a stop on the Underground Railroad, and we'll give you some advice on what to do about robocalls. Oh, and people are voting today to choose the next mayor of Chicago. They've got lots of choices, 14 candidates. Tomorrow on the 21st, we will bring you the results of the Chicago mayor's race. But first, the State Board of Education says there are more than 50,000 homeless students in Illinois. That means there are tens of thousands of homeless families. When it comes to providing help, families often shy away from the better-known options like shelters. Today, we wanted to talk about a new and little-used state law that allows school districts to provide some relief to help rehouse families who need it. It's one small workaround in the bigger issue of affordable housing, and Lee Gaines has been reporting on this. She's an education reporter for WILL in the Illinois Newsroom. That's a collaboration across the state of public radio stations. Lee, welcome back to the program.
Glad to be here.
Lee, so first of all, I wonder how you found out about this story.
So I actually found out about this story simply by reading the law. I was reading the law about what homeless students in Illinois are entitled to, and I found this section of the law titled Homeless Prevention, and I thought it was really interesting, and I started asking some questions, and I found out that it was a relatively recent law, or part of the law, that was passed in 2017. And that's kind of how I got on the trail.
And that's how that brought you to a Des Plaines resident named Chantel. We're not using her last name to protect her privacy. Can you tell us about, she works at a department store. She has two daughters in enrolled in school district.
She has one daughter enrolled in the school district. Her youngest daughter is four, so she's about to be.
And how did she and her family become homeless?
So she also lives with her mother and her two daughters, and they were living in a townhome in Des Plaines for several years, and then the landlord decided to sell the building. And she gave her about a month to find a new place to live, and unfortunately, Chantel was unable to find a place to live because she didn't have a credit score, she said, and also her income level was fairly low. She makes $12 an hour at the department store, and a lot of landlords wanted to see her with an income that was three times the rent that she was going to be paying, and that just wasn't possible for her.
Mm. And then, so then what happened?
So this happened last summer. So August 1st, she said she was into the hotels. She really did not want to bring her family to a shelter. She felt like that would be unsafe. So she moved her family into a hotel. I think they lived between three different hotels. That's how the school got involved.
You actually spoke to her. So let's hear a little bit of how her school or her daughter's school found out that they did not have a house.
And I popped my trunk for my daughter to grab something. He saw all of my things in the car, and he spazzed out. He never saw me that way before. He was like, what's going on? You know, talk to me, open up. And at that point, I did the same. I started crying, and he told me to come to his office.
And yeah, so that in that clip, she's talking about her daughter's principal, who found out that she was homeless because she was actually bringing her daughter back and forth to school with all of her things in her car because she was never really sure where they were going to stay that night.
Hmm. And so then how did the school help?
So the school ended up using this law, and as far as I'm aware, there are only two families that have so far benefited from this law, Chantiel's and another family, and they're both families within the same school district, that is East Main District 63, and so basically what they did was they used some of their transportation funds to provide some temporary rental assistance to Chantiel and her family. So they paid for most of her first month's rent, and she really needed that temporary financial boost in order to get into the house that she now lives in Des Plaines. Another interesting thing about that, though, is even with that grant money from the district, she still had to have her pastor from Evanston vouch for her to the landlord. Because even with the money being offered by the school district, she said the landlord really didn't want to rent to her because of her credit score. And it took, a man of God basically coming in and saying, you should do this to get her family into that house.
That's Lee Gaines with the Illinois Newsroom. We're getting a sneak peek of some of the reporting she's been doing. You can hear the story later this week. She mentioned Chantiel's school district, or her daughter's school district, and that's East Main School District 63. And I wanted to introduce the associate superintendent with that district, who's on the line from Des Plaines now. The associate superintendent is Sean Schleiser. Associate superintendent, thanks for being with us. I appreciate it.
I'm glad to be joining you.
We also have Barbara Duffield joining our conversation now. She's on the line from Washington, where she's executive director of the nonprofit Schoolhouse Connection. Thanks for being with us as well, Barbara.
It's my pleasure.
Barbara, as you're listening to Lee outline Chantiel's story, someone who is working but cannot afford housing for her family, having to use savings, whatever she has, to live in a hotel. How familiar is this story to you?
It's all too familiar. It is all too familiar. The number of children and youth who are experiencing homelessness across the nation is large and growing. And in many circumstances, it is it's a similar situation of having economic challenges and then finding oneself without a home. It's sometimes the story, there's a variation on the story. Sometimes there are additional challenges beyond the housing and economic challenge, mental health, addiction, other issues, and that's another variation that schools confront. And for children, with their education, it can be very, very disruptive, regardless of the cause of their homelessness.
Associate Superintendent, I wonder how you all were able to hear about this. I don't know how you knew about this law and how you were able to use, I think Lee mentioned, some of the district's transportation budget to help them.
Yeah, so initially I learned of the law just through communication provided by Regional Office of Education here. And because I was aware of the law, when I became aware of some of the families, I contacted a local homeless liaison and worked with him and a homeless service agency to assist the families in becoming rehoused.
Had anyone in your district had this problem ever come up before? Is this something that you all have dealt with before?
Absolutely. This about 1.5 to 2% of our 3,500 preschool through eighth grade students are homeless, and it's an ongoing problem. So it is something that we deal with on a daily basis, and this law has allowed us to help a few families, and we hope we're able to use the law to help some more.
How much money did it cost to help rehouse Chantiel's family?
Approximately $1,500. And I think one important point is that while it was $1,500, the cost to transport the family to and from hotels for the foreseeable future, say one school year, could be in excess of $10,000 if they're within, say, 10 miles of the school district. So it's a cost saving to the school district, as well as to the state.
Yeah, so the reason that it's a cost savings to the school district is because there's a federal law called the McKinney-Vento Act. And basically what that does is it mandates that schools pay for the transportation of homeless students to their school of origin. So in Chantiel's case and in another family's case, they ended up living outside the district in these hotels, and it was costing, like Dr. Schleiser said, it was costing them, the district, quite a bit of money to transport them back and forth to school. I actually spoke with a homeless school liaison or district liaison. His name's Tom Buchler, and he's kind of responsible for this law getting passed in Illinois. And what he told me was doing an informal survey of, you know, about 20 school districts in the northern Chicago suburbs, he found that they were spending about $800,000 collectively transporting homeless kids to and from school. So that inspired him to say, hey, I think that we can actually save money if we instead use that to give them some temporary financial assistance to either keep them in their home or to rehouse them.
And obviously, of course, logically, that's a better solution to the problem. And I wanted to ask you, Lee, just about, we're talking about costs. I wonder what kind of toll, just for Chantille, what she said, what kind of costs her family had to endure being in this situation, especially when she was in, when she was in this hotel situation.
Yeah, so she was in the hotels for about 2.5 months, and she said, you know, all of her money that she was making at her job was going to pay for the hotel and also the food, because there's no kitchen in a hotel. So they were being forced to eat out all the time. It really wasn't good for her health or her children's health or her mother's health. There was also it took a toll on the mental health of the kids and the family as well. They were all living in a single room together. They had no space. Her youngest daughter couldn't go and play outside. Her oldest daughter couldn't have her friends over. So it really took quite a toll on the family.
We actually have some audio of Chantille talking about that. Let's hear a little bit.
Between the three hotels we went to, it was like a enclosed place for my girls. They're used to running around. They're used to being able to play with toys and other things like that. My youngest daughter would always want toys, toys, toys. And the money spent in the hotels, along with buying outside food, it drains you.
That's Chantille, who spoke with Illinois Newsroom reporter Lee Gaines, who's in studio with me here in Urbana. We're also speaking with Barbara Duffield, who's executive director of Schoolhouse Connection, and associate superintendent of the East Main School District, Sean Schleiser. Barbara, can I ask you, just as we're hearing about the costs, it struck me, we think about the cost of her paying for a hotel, but then that whole idea of the costs of eating out, it sort of seems when you're in a situation like this, the costs probably tend to spiral in a way that most of us who haven't been in this situation haven't thought about.
That's true. And I think, you know, one point that's really important here is that the situation that's being described of staying in the motel and paying for it, the U.S. Department of Housing and Urban Development doesn't actually consider that to be homeless. So a family in that situation, with the stress of the children not being able to eat, moving from place to place, staying in motels in that fashion, they're not eligible for homeless assistance from the U.S. Department of Education. And that, I mean, from the U.S. Department of Housing and Urban Development, but they are eligible for school support under the McKinney-Vento Act. So that's one large, large challenge, is that some of the housing assistance and priorities for housing are not there for families staying in motels. And as a result, schools see a lot of the challenges, too, because they can't access those funds that are already there for housing for families in these situations.
Associate Superintendent Schleiser, is it hard to, I mean, you said that you had a number of how many families in your district perhaps were dealing with the issue of homelessness, but I imagine there's such a stigma attached to this. It's probably hard for families to even know that this help is available.
Yeah, so we do train our school administrators, our secretaries, our teachers, and others on how to spot signs of homelessness, so that when they notice that a family may be homeless, we can have a conversation with the family to find out if there are any services we can provide to them, or, you know, or help.
And I wonder also if we have an idea of what we think a family who is homeless looks like, and probably that idea is wrong.
Yeah, absolutely. Usually people think about a homeless family or person on the street corner, and oftentimes a family may be living with another family member or a friend, and that's called doubling up, and they may not even know they're homeless. We have people living in cars and shelters and hotels. homelessness looks different depending on the person and the family.
Mm-hmm. Lee, so we've been hearing how the East Main School District has been working on this. Is this pretty unusual? What do you know about this law you mentioned was actually passed in 2017. Have other school districts also been able to help families with housing in the way that the East Main School District has been?
Not that I'm aware of. And I mentioned him before, Tom Buchler, kind of the inspiration behind this law, is also not aware of any other school district that has done this in the state. I spent a lot of time calling different school districts in Southern Illinois, in Central Illinois, and I ran into an issue where a lot of the homeless school liaisons working in those districts didn't even know this law existed. It didn't get very much attention at all, if any, when it was passed. So I think a lot of people, there's still an awareness issue where a lot of schools don't know that this is an option. And then I think that there's also a reluctance on the part of a lot of schools to do this because they don't necessarily understand how it's going to work in practice. One thing that the East Main School District did, and they have to do, is they partnered with a social service agency to cut the check to the landlord and to actually work to get the family not only rehoused, but get them casework services, you know, helping them with money management issues, helping them to know where the food pantries are. There was a lot of social work services provided to these families. And in some sections of the state, there just aren't a lot of social service providers, or those providers might be overloaded and not be able to take on these kinds of cases. I have heard that from folks that I've talked to in other parts of the state.
We have to take a break. When we come back, we'll continue this conversation about how East Main School District 63, that's in Des Plaines, how they've been trying to help some of their students who are having problems with housing and the issue of homelessness. Stay tuned. You're listening to The 21st. Welcome back to The 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. And if you're just tuning in, we're talking about the tens of thousands of students in Illinois who are dealing with homelessness and the way that school districts are trying to help. Lee Gaines, an education reporter from the Illinois Newsroom, has been telling us about this relatively new law that was passed in 2017 that allows schools to help out with housing in some situations. We're talking about how the East Main School District 63 has done that. Sean Schleicher is with us. He's the associate superintendent there. Barbara Duffield is also on the line from Chicago, where she's executive director with the nonprofit Schoolhouse Connection. Barbara, how common are laws like what Illinois has passed? Is this something that other states across the country are doing to try to help particularly student populations?
There are a few states that have taken some steps at the state level to address the challenges of student homelessness. This particular legislation is unique in the sense that it's about redirecting existing local dollars for education to be used for housing. In other states, for example, in Massachusetts, there's a line item specifically for school districts to pay for the transportation of students who are homeless. So it's extra dollars from the state to school districts to pay for transportation. In the state of Washington, for example, there's extra dollars that are for housing supports, but it's provided to school districts because school districts have that unique position. They know their students, they know what families are going through, and so having school districts administer additional grants in partnership with agencies for housing supports can be very helpful.
And I wanted to ask both of you, it seems obvious that a student needs a home and that helps them be a good student, but I just wanted to ask you all about the role of schools in this situation. Barbara, why do you think it's important that schools are taking part in helping students in this situation?
schools have a critical role for a number of different reasons, but one of the most important is that education is the best way out of future homelessness. Children who get a high school degree are much less likely to be homeless as adults, and anything we can do to stabilize their education is going to be preventative for future homelessness and for future experiences of poverty. Schools also are one of the unique institutions because while there may not be housing or shelter for every family who needs it, there is a mandated seat in the classroom for every child experiencing homelessness, so they provide a sense of structure and normalcy and stability that may not otherwise be there. And of course, as we've seen, they're a hub for the community for all sorts of social services, you know, housing and beyond.
Associate Superintendent Schleiser, can I just ask you about that? I mean, I think there might be some people who are surprised thinking, why did you get involved with this as a school district? Isn't that something a social service agency should be doing?
Well, we got involved because, you know, our goal is to provide the highest quality education possible to our students. And when a child experiences homelessness, it's very difficult for a child to be successful in school. Mobility has a huge impact on a child's ability to learn, and the stability that staying in the same school provides and the security makes a huge difference in long-term academic, social, and emotional well-being and success. Because our goal is to provide a high-quality education to kids and we have the ability to help, we want to help. It's the right thing to do.
And I thought we could just end here hearing a little bit more from Shantiel. Here she's telling Lee a little bit more about her current housing and financial situation. As Lee said, this was last summer, and she's now in a stable housing situation.
Like myself, I'm a low-income family, very low-income. I can't really afford the amount of rent that's here, but I work hard enough every day, and I know that at any point, if I fall behind, the school told me that they're here for me. I feel I owe someone something because they did so much for me. So much.
I wonder, Associate Superintendent, how it feels to know that on the one hand, you were able to help someone in your district who obviously really needed the help, but also knowing that there's this much bigger problem here, which is people who are working full time and still not able to afford housing.
Yeah, I mean, to help the families is certainly very gratifying and rewarding. But we also know that there are many, many homeless families who need assistance. It's a significant issue in our society, and I'm just glad that we could provide some assistance to a few families at this point.
Well, thank you both for taking the time to be with us. Sean Schleiser is the Associate Superintendent at the East Main School District. Barbara Duffield is the Executive Director of Schoolhouse Connection. And we met these folks through Lee Gaines, who's a reporter with the Illinois Newsroom. Look out for Lee's stories later this week. She'll have more of this information. She gave us a little sneak peek here on the 21st, but this story will be coming out later this week. All of you, thanks for being with me. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Lee Gaines is an education reporter with WILL in the Illinois Newsroom. She and her colleagues are going to be working actually on a series about affordable housing in Illinois. This is one sneak peek that she has given us. This story will come out later this week, but it's part of a whole series. And so we wanted to ask you what stories you would like us to look into when it comes to housing. I wonder if you've had a hard time finding a place to rent or buy a home, if you have questions about how to make it easier to afford a home. All this year, we've been debuting a new feature where you can ask us questions that we will try to answer on air. So we wanted to make them housing focused. And if you go to askthe21st.org, you can share your question with us. That's askthe21st.org. You can share your question. You can share a story. And we will start looking into this for you guys. Illinois' early history is filled with stories about slavery on both sides. Yes, we were founded as a free state, but the practice was still allowed to continue in different forms. As you've heard, if you are a close listener to the 21st, free Black men and women were still at risk of being kidnapped and sold back into slavery across state lines. But there were also stories of freedom, like New Philadelphia, the first town founded by African Americans in the country. That happened right here in Illinois. In southern Illinois, free Black communities were also on the front lines of the Underground Railroad. But that Underground Railroad also made its way north through Illinois. And in DuPage County, a building at Wheaton College called Blanchard Hall was one of these stops for former slaves who were seeking freedom. On the line with us now from Wheaton College is its school's president, Phil Ryken. President Ryken, good morning. Welcome to the 21st. Thanks for being with us this morning.
Good morning, Nyla. I'm speaking to you from historic Blanchard Hall on the campus of Wheaton College.
Thank you. And we know about this story because of reporting from Dennis Rodkin, who is a real estate reporter with Crane Chicago Business and a contributor to WBEZ's What's That Building series. Hey, Dennis, welcome back. Welcome to the 21st. Thanks for being here.
Hi, Nyla. How are you?
I'm good, thank you. Let's start, President Ryken, with you. Your father was a Wheaton professor and you grew up on the campus. I wonder if did you always know about Wheaton, and in particular Blanchard Hall's interesting place in Illinois' abolitionist history?
So, you know, I've known about those rumors at least for a long time. My family moved here when I was 1 year old. My father actually is still teaching. He's semi-retired. This is his 51st year of teaching at the college. And I've lived half of my life within earshot of the bells of Edmund Chapel and often passed by Blanchard Hall. One thing that's funny about it, Nyla, is that there have long been rumors that there are tunnels on Wheaton's campus. And I think somehow at some point, rumors of the Underground Railroad got mixed in with rumors about tunnels. So students still sometimes ask me about the tunnels, which we don't have, but we're so thrilled to know now, you know, historically it's been demonstrated we were part of the Underground Railroad.
And so Wheaton was founded in 1860, which when we think about that year in American history, Abraham Lincoln was elected president. We're just before the Civil War. Where does Wheaton's founding fit into all of that, and in particular, the abolitionist part of this?
Yeah, so the precursor to Wheaton College was the Illinois Institute, and it was founded in 1853. And from the beginning, there was a strong abolitionist commitment among all of the Christian people, mainly Methodists, that were part of the founding of the school. And it's in 1860 that our founding president, Jonathan Blanchard, comes to the college, and he was a pretty well-known figure nationally in the abolitionist movement. And he would have been invited to become president of the college because the college already had those strong abolitionist commitments. And it's reflected in the fact that basically a third of the student body, even in those early days, went off to fight in the Civil War, mainly, although not exclusively, for the Union. But this was a strong abolitionist community from at least the 1850s.
So, Dennis, you were able to tour a Blanchard Hall with the college architect. Do we know what it looked like in the early days of the college?
Yes, it was much smaller than it is now. It's about 75,000 square feet. It was probably less than 10,000 square feet when it was built. It's a stone building. Well, the large building is all stone. The small one from built in the 1850s was as well. And you sort of have to picture some of the spaces because they've been renovated out of existence. Back in the 1980s, before the not the abolitionist history, but the Underground Railroad history was confirmed on campus, the spaces were renovated so that you no longer see, for example, this chapel where fugitives from slavery were apparently welcomed at chapel services. This was somewhat brazen that these people were not only or necessarily hiding in tunnels under the building, but welcomed into the chapel. Unfortunately, that chapel isn't there anymore. What would have been the chapel is now staircases and landings and study areas. So you don't really see what it looked like at the time when you're inside, but you do when standing outside see this old building, which has now been sort of engulfed by the later wings built in the decades after.
President Ryken, I wonder if you can explain a little bit more about when we say, so Dennis was saying, obviously it was a stop on the Underground Railroad to the point that there were escaping slaves who were attending chapel. What else, what did it mean for Blanchard Hall to be a stop on the Underground Railroad?
So the original building would have been had multiple purposes. There were chapel services. There were some students living in residence in the main building, the old main. That is typical to many private colleges from the 19th century. Would have been a building for classrooms, for a small library. So really, it would have been the hub of everything having to do with the college. It all would have been taking place in this building. And I agree with Dennis that there was something really brazen about this. And by the way, Dennis has done excellent work on this. Just really appreciate some of the things he's explained for us about Blanchard Hall. But here you have a very prominent building on a hill, or at least what counts for a hill in the state of Illinois. And I think it would have presented a really interesting prospect, this very prominent building in the community as fugitive slaves were coming into the community. It's not a place that you would think of as a place that's out of the way at all. And to have fugitive slaves kind of in the mix of student life meant that there were a lot of people that knew that this was a stop on the Underground Railroad. I think that's a sign of how strong the abolitionist sentiment was within the community, that people felt like this was an appropriate and really safe thing to do. And to our knowledge, there was never a problem with this stop on the Underground Railroad.
And so, Dennis, I imagine that this is probably pretty unusual to have in that time period, this been done in such an open fashion.
I think it is. It's this really interesting sort of open secret, which obviously can't be wide open because some people who found out might have cracked down. But what I found really interesting is, the Underground Railroad depended on people keeping secrets, on a clandestine movement of people from place to place to get them from slave holding to freedom. But in Wheaton, because the college is founded on abolitionism. So we mentioned Wheaton is founded in 1860 out of the Illinois Institute, which was founded in the 1850s. The two presidents of the Illinois Institute, one after the other, were also abolitionists. It's founded by an abolitionist sect of Methodism. They've broken off specifically to pursue abolitionism as a religious virtue, a principle of their religion. So because this is a community where ending slaveholding matters, then it becomes this place where we would very boldly say, yeah, we're welcoming these people. We're inviting them to chapel. We're harboring them on their way from one place to another, which might be another might be downtown Chicago, where they can disappear into a large city, or where they can board a boat for Canada or another place. And that, to me, is what distinguishes Wheaton and Blanchard Hall, is this idea that it's a community value. So here within our community, we're going to talk about it openly.
Mm. President Ryken, I know we just have a few minutes left, but I just wanted to ask you, I think we're in a moment where we spend a lot of time talking about racial justice, and I wonder how Wheaton's past informs its present thinking about the role that Wheaton should be playing in this conversation in 2019.
Yeah, so that's a great question, Nyla. And I'll just add to what Dennis was saying. There's a quote from one of Jonathan Blanchard's daughters where she says, in Wheaton, the Underground Railroad was operated above ground. It's kind of a little tantalizing sentence that captures something of the mentality and brazenness, I think we've called it, the boldness of those early abolitionists. I think the way I want to think about Wheaton's abolitionist heritage, we're in one sense very proud of the fact that we were a stop on the Underground Railroad, and we want to take inspiration from that, but we don't want to be self-congratulatory about that. I think the work of racial reconciliation, racial equality, justice, which we at Wheaton College would consider to be a very important biblical principle, that's an ongoing and unfinished work in American society, and that's true on our own campus as well. And we face various kinds of challenges with students from many different racial backgrounds worshiping together, studying together, working and playing together. We want to be inspired by that early history and what it means for us, but we don't want to regard that as something that's a sort of finished work. We want to see it as an ongoing and important and vital calling for Wheaton College today.
And one last quick question for you. Is this something now that I think maybe more students will know about in terms of the history, especially thanks to some of the reporting Dennis has done?
Yeah, for sure. And anytime this comes up in the news, that's a positive thing. I think we've tried to put some historical markers. This is a registered historic place now. We love for visitors to be to encounter a little bit of this history. And we also now have, through the work of our my president's art commission, gallery space on the ground floor of Blanchard Hall, which illustrates from early print, Civil War era, and afterwards some of the African American experience at that time. So there's a lot to learn. Right here on Wheaton's campus, and we always welcome visitors. It's open 6 days a week and easy to walk into the building and learn more.
Thanks for taking the time to be with us, President Ryken. We'll say thanks to you, Dennis. If you can stick around, I just want to ask you one more question. But Phil Ryken is the president of Wheaton College. Stay tuned. You're listening to The 21st. Thanks for tuning into The 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. We are talking about some Illinois history in terms of Wheaton College, and we're learning about a very, as we were just hearing, an above-ground part of the Underground Railroad that took place in DuPage County. We know about this in part because of some of reporting recently done by WBEZ's What's That Building series. Contributor Dennis Rodkin is with us. He's a real estate reporter, also with Great Chicago Business. Dennis, I wonder, one thing that stood out for me, what you were just talking about, and as well as from your reporting, is the fact that Blanchard Hall does look very different now, and many of the areas that were used by former slaves have been renovated. Do we know why those spaces were lost? Was it just not an awareness of this being part of the college's history?
Yeah, I think that's it. I think by the time, or at the time when the renovations, when the last big round of renovations was done in the 1980s, it was still rumor. The president talked about this idea that everybody knew there were tunnels and people decided, oh, that's where the fugitive slaves were. And it's possible that they were at some point. But in the 80s, people still, it hadn't been confirmed. It wasn't well known. In recent years, there have been documents that have come to light. There have been journals and articles by people from the 1860s attached to Wheaton College, who've said things, who've written things like what I was talking about, this idea that a few hundred people might meet a fugitive from slavery in the Wheaton College chapel, that sort of thing. Those confirmations weren't around. So in the 80s, people, you know, why keep a space that's subject of rumor? If they were renovating today, they might have a different approach to the chapel and other spaces.
But there are still some spaces and some graves, including on campus, that remain that reflect this history.
Yeah, there's one that is absolutely fascinating. The grave itself was on campus, but the obelisk, the grave marker, has been moved into the lobby of Blanchard Hall. The obelisk had been lost, so there's a plaque for the grave, but the memorial to James Burr is right there when you walk into Blanchard Hall. James Burr was an abolitionist in the 1840s, before even the Illinois Institute, which becomes Wheaton College, is founded. He's working in southern Illinois to help slaves escape from Missouri into freedom. He spends time in jail. He spends 5 years in prison because of it. And when he dies in 1859, having no connection at this point to what's at that time called the Illinois Institute, he leaves part of his estate, which was not great. He left $300 to the college, and also asked to be buried there because he wanted to be buried on soil that had not been ever tainted by slavery. The money he left was for scholarships to people, to young men specifically, who were wholly devoted to the cause of Christ and opposed to slavery. And so his grave, again, is on the campus. And his grave marker is part of this sort of monument that they have inside Blanchard Hall.
That's Dennis Rodkin. We will tweet out Dennis's story he just did on this for WBEZ if you'd like to learn more about it. Dennis, thanks for taking the time to speak with us.
I'm happy to, Nyla.
Okay, how many of you listening have gotten calls like this?
To inform you that IRS is filing lawsuit against you. To get more information about this case file, please call immediately on our department number 20.
Robocalls are frustrating, annoying. Maybe you've even gotten them in Chinese. I started getting these a month or two ago.
你好，这里是总领事馆最后一次通知。你有一封紧急文件尚未领取，熟悉咨询请按九。
They're more than just a nuisance. These calls can actually be dangerous for particularly vulnerable consumers. And a study conducted by the telecom services firm Your Mail found that consumers were hit with almost 50 billion automated calls in 2018. And in Illinois, we had the sixth most robocalls in the country. We had 1.8 billion calls. And if you're one of those billions, it feels like there's very little you can do to stop these calls. But the Illinois Watchdog Group Citizens Utility Board, or CUB, has just released a guide to fighting robocalls and its director of communication. Jim Chilson is online with us now from Chicago. Hi, Jim. Welcome back to the 21st.
Oh, glad to be here. How are you doing?
I'm okay, Jim. I wonder, though, for folks who are super frustrated by robocalls, how bad of a problem was this in 2018? Is this getting worse?
Yeah, unfortunately, it does seem like it's getting worse. We see this as one of the most significant consumer issues of 2019. As you said in the intro, you know, you got nearly 50 billion robocalls in 2018. That's about 150 per person, which is just unbelievable over the year. And that was a 57% increase over the previous year. And there are two reasons for that, I think, is that number one, just based on the research I've done, number one is that the technology allows robocallers to make thousands of calls per minute. And it's been hard for policy to keep up with that technology. But also, I think there hasn't been a lot of movement in terms of policy in Washington. You know, back in the Obama administration had a very tough rule against robocalls that it passed, the FCC under the Obama administration. But that was overturned. Part of it, key parts of it, were overturned in the U.S. Court of Appeals. And it was all over the definition of what an auto dialer is. And since then, robocalls have just skyrocketed.
And so, yeah. By the way, our great 21st producers just translated that Chinese call said in part, "Hello, this is your last warning." And that does remind me to say that not all robocalls are illegal. Some are actually pretty helpful. And so I wonder if we should remind people about the good robocalls that people get.
Yeah, absolutely. Some of those 50 billion calls were good ones. You know, during the polar vortex, I got an automatic robocall from my children's school letting me know that the next 2 days there was going to be no school. I appreciate that. When there's ever a security risk at my children's school, we're notified about it through a robocall. You know, there are good robocalls out there, but, you know, a definition of a robocall is any pre-recorded message from a computer-generated dialer. That's the definition of a robocall. And under law, commercial robocalls, that's anything selling a good or service, those are illegal unless a company gets your written permission. So you can imagine, I'm sure everybody's rolling their eyes right now because, you know, these companies never get anybody's permission. And this is a pocketbook issue. You know, the Consumer Reports estimates that about $350 million a year is lost through telephone scams. So this is a big deal.
That's what I wanted to ask you about, because obviously I feel like these calls wouldn't be happening if at some point they weren't effective in some way. And unfortunately, there is some very serious damage being done to some consumers with this.
Absolutely. And, you know, you gave a very good example. It's been called the Chinese consulate scam. And actually, one of the reasons we did this guide was because in December, CUB was hit with these calls. It would go from one phone to the next throughout our office. And I began to think that, you know, we're a consumer group. We should be, you know, we're getting hit with these robocalls. You know, imagine what people are, you know, everyday people are feeling. And we wanted to give, you know, people a free guide that would give them some tips on doing something to stem the tide.
Right. I was going to say, that's happened to us. That even happens during the show. We get calls and people tie up our phone lines with these. So I wonder, first of all, with the ones that, I mean, do we know what we can do to prevent these from happening? Well, because I think everyone, a lot of people know, okay, you can report them to the FTC, to the FCC, and all of those sorts of things.
You know, I don't mean to sound so negative about policy. There has been some movement lately among technology people and the telecom companies to come up with some type of technology they could offer to consumers to block spoofing. You know, that's where they send you, a robocaller sends you a number that looks like it's coming from maybe your neighborhood or, somebody you know, and then you pick up and that's when they hit you with this pitch. But the problem is that there hasn't been anything that is requiring the companies, to do something about it. So there's no silver bullet. I think it's a lot about trial and error. That's one thing we learned. We filled that guide with tips. But it doesn't seem like there's any silver bullet. You have to just try and see what works. And rule number one is don't engage. Don't talk. Try not to pick up these calls. If you do pick up, don't press any buttons, even if they tell you press this button to unsubscribe from these calls. Because what that's doing is that's a robocaller trying to see if there's a live person at that number. And if you press a button, that just tells them, oh, there's a live person
there.
So
don't ever engage is what you're saying.
Don't engage. That's number one. But also always check with your phone company to find out what free services they offer. I'll start with smartphones, but use your smartphone's do not disturb feature. Most, if not all, smartphones have a do not disturb feature. You can set it so that your contacts list still rings your phone, but all other calls will go directly to voicemail. That has been something that several people have said can be quite effective, even though it's quite simple. Always call your company to see if they offer apps or any type of free services. But that is one thing for smartphone owners that I think can be quite effective. There's always third-party apps. The thing is that those might cost, a monthly fee. But if you have digital home phone service, a lot of people have this through Comcast. Sometimes they call them modern landlines or U-verse. Always check with your carrier. A lot of times these digital home phone service offer a great app for free. It's called Nomo Robo, and it actually will screen calls for you, and it's been very effective. A lot of people have told us that can be very effective.
We got emails about that, and when we asked our listeners, we did get an email from someone saying they use Nomo Robo.
Absolutely, and what's beautiful about it is if you get it on your smartphone, it's going to cost you a small monthly fee. We love anything that's free, and it's absolutely free for customers on digital home phone service. It depends on your company, but Comcast and AT&T have offered that service for free. So check with your company to see if you can get that if you have digital home phone service. Sadly, traditional landlines, we have a soft spot in our heart for people who have traditional copper landlines, and there's a significant number of people that still have them, even though AT&T is doing everything to kick them off those landlines. For a lot of people, those can be, their most their best connection to the world, their cheapest and most reliable. They have the fewest. They're sometimes the most vulnerable to these robocalls. People with copper landlines might be older, and like with any scam, they might be more vulnerable to scams. Scam artists might prey on them, and they have the fewest options. You mentioned Umail in your intro. The CEO of Umail tells his mom, who has a landline, just let it go to voicemail. Screen the call. If it's a robocaller, it's likely they're going to hang up. If it's somebody you're right by the phone, pick it up and start talking. We have a copper landline at our house. We also have a lot of smartphones in our house, but we have a copper landline. And that has proven to be amazingly effective. Just those robocallers hang up immediately. You don't even have to engage with them. Finally, we tell everybody this. Join the Do Not Call Registry. With the explosion of robocalls, a lot of people get very cynical about the Do Not Call Registry, but it will still block a lot of calls. It blocks the calls from legitimate companies who are following the rules, but still it will lessen the telemarketing calls that you get. It's just not going to – the scam artists are not going to follow the Do Not Call Registry, but there still are a lot of companies that will, and that will reduce.
And that's a good way. We just have about a minute left. I just want to ask quickly about election robocalls and texts. I'm thinking particularly for folks in Chicago, they're getting a lot of these. Are those legal?
You're absolutely right. And you know what? There are exceptions to the robocall laws. So political calls are allowed, debt collectors, info-only calls, that would be if your airport, if the airline calls you to tell you that your flight's been canceled, and also banks and telephone carriers. If they do the robocalls themselves, they can hit you, and also charities. So, again, a lot of people like to get those calls. A lot of people also don't like to get those calls. But, you know, if that company is pitching a good or a service and they don't have your written permission, it's illegal.
The Guide to Fighting Robocalls is from the Citizens Utility Board. We will link to it at our website at 21stshow.org. We will tweet it out. Thanks, Jim, for being with us.
Thank you so much. Have a good day.
Coming up on tomorrow's program, we're going to bring you the results of Chicago's mayor's race. Folks are voting today. There's 14 people in the race. There's no clear front runner, so it seems unlikely that one of those people will get the 50% of the vote needed to win. If not, the top two will go to a runoff. We'll talk about that on tomorrow. That's it for us today. I mentioned 21stshow.org. That's a great way to contact us. It's got all of our social media handles. If you want to send us an email, if you'd like to leave us a voicemail, we promise we will not robocall you. You can go to our website, 21stshow.org. We've also got lots of past shows there, and we're available on podcasts, too. The band Public Access provides our theme music. Special thanks to them. The 21st is a production of Illinois Public Media, and I'm Nyla Boodoo. Thanks for listening. We'll see you tomorrow.